The Church of God, the Eternal, presents the 19th message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled A Survey of the Books of Samuel, given in Eugene, Oregon, January 3rd, 2026.
Well, we've been covering this series on the books of Samuel, and we're going to carry right on forward with this. I do really want to get as much of this series accomplished as possible. Not every single sermon I give, every once in a while I insert a different topic, but for the most part, you see that I am focusing on this particular series. This is now the 19th message in the series. Previously, if you recall, we covered the aftermath of David's absolutely unimaginable, unexpected defeat of the giant Goliath at the end of 1 Samuel chapter 17, including then King Saul's embrace of David as that champion he had hoped for, wanted for, probably given up hope after 40 days. And then along comes young David and defeats the giant, and everything changes overnight. King Saul is thrilled, welcomes David into his royal court. And then the first half of chapter 18, approximately, that we covered also, showing the special bond, the friendship that was formed from between David and Jonathan, who became fast friends. But then the problems start when Saul turns to jealousy after the Israelites, now in this parade in song, laud David more than King Saul. That kind of becomes the trigger that changes Saul's view toward David. David, as we read, earns a good reputation among not only the soldiers he's assigned in Saul's army, but also all of the people in general, which is a pretty major accomplishment because you're still talking about a teenager. So the guidance and the inspiration that God was giving him, literally to know the right things to do and not to do in given circumstances, because all eyes were on him as that unexpected champion. He was thrust into the limelight now, and he could have blown it so easily. And yet what we see in the account is that he actually capitalized upon every one of these opportunities and became a celebrity within the nation, a hero, a champion. So because of that, it amplified even more Saul's disdain, fear, jealousy, and antipathy toward David. We saw also in the first part of chapter 18, the first attempt upon David's life with Saul throwing the javelin at David, not just once, but twice, and David has to escape away. And henceforth, Saul now is going to become set upon David's destruction. And what we're going to see, and we're going to see it today as we go through the rest of chapter 18, and hopefully I'm going to try and get through all of chapter 19. We'll see how that goes. But what you're going to see is this back and forth in the mind of Saul. He really is a tortured being. And he seems to go from one mind to another, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. But you see a sincerity in him because he appreciates the things that David did for the good of the nation, but at the very same time, he's got this different mind and the reasons for it. We'll talk about that. But the main thrust that we see is Saul is the enemy of David, and that's going to be that's going to be the thrust until Saul dies. It's not going to change, even though there are temporary reprieves. So we're right now in 1 Samuel chapter 18. We're going to pick it up where we left off, which is verse 17. Here we find now that Saul is going to scheme against David by offering him a wife of his oldest daughter. Here we read verse 17. Saul said to David, "Behold, my eldest daughter Merab, her will I give thee to wife. Only," here's the condition to marrying the princess, "only be thou valiant for me and fight the Eternal's battles." For Saul said, let not mine hand be upon him. Meaning Saul said, meaning Saul thought, Saul schemed. His real underlying intent for this was not altruistic at all. Saul said, let not my hand be upon him. He's saying, I don't want to go against David outwardly, and I certainly don't want to slaughter him outwardly. But let the hand of the Philistines be upon him. So this is Saul's scheme to get rid of David, is to set David up so that he actually gets slaughtered on the battlefield. Oh, and then he could laud him as a great hero. Oh, too bad. Aren't we sorry that we lost David? And yet he'd be rid of him. So that was the scheme. Now, you know the rest of the story. What I find interesting about this is exactly the kind of scheme that David himself is going to employ when he's older. Don't turn to it, but we're going to cut, when we get to 2 Samuel chapter 11, that's the story of Bathsheba. And in order for David to get rid of Bathsheba's husband, when he wouldn't take the opportunity with this furlough from the front lines to go home and sleep with his wife so that then it might look like he was the father of the child and not David. So David decides he's going to get rid of him. He's literally, and so what does David do? So this is years later, and yet David's going to do exactly the same thing that Saul is doing here, which is to have Uriah sent to the front lines in the hottest part of the battle with the hope that he gets killed and solves the king's problem. And as you already know, that's exactly what happens, because Uriah is going to die. Ironically, David is not going to die in the scheme of Saul. But the two are very, very similar if you think about it. Now, the orientation of mind is very, very different between Saul and David, which is what this entire series is about, to amplify that distinction. The difference is David was repentant, Saul was not. So David is offered now this wonderful opportunity to marry the oldest daughter of King Saul, which is a great honor and a position of prestige and power, by the way, to be the king's son-in-law. What is David's reply? Well, it's very surprising and unexpected to Saul and everyone else. Verse 18, David said unto Saul, who am I? And what is my life or my father's family in Israel that I should be son-in-law to the king? David's not putting on a front here. This is a sincere expression of humility. He is not pretentiously looking for an opportunity to take advantage and go, oh, thank you, king. Yes, I'd love to be your son-in-law. He's seriously saying, I'm not worthy of that. Who am I? He's hearkening back, as we're going to see in a little bit, to his family. It has no real standing of significance within the nation. And he's saying, I'm not really worthy of this. So he's still seeing himself in a very humble position, which throws Saul completely off his game, by the way. Verse 19, but it came to pass at the time when Merib, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, meaning if David had accepted her and agreed to this marriage covenant. So David basically put the kibosh on that. That instead she was given unto Adriel, the Maholathite, to wife. Okay, so I try to look up these people, even though they're kind of secondary. Who was this Israelite who did marry the oldest daughter of Saul? We're going to see this story also in 2 Samuel 21:8. You don't need to turn there. Very little is known about this man, Adriel, except that he was likely, scholars think, of a noble family from either Issachar or Manasseh. The fact that he marries the king's daughter and has five sons. And 2 Samuel 21:8 is often misunderstood because it calls them the sons of Michael, but what the scholars all believe is true, and I think is also supported by the context of it, is Merib probably dies early. Nothing is said about her, except she has five sons. And then down the line, these adult sons are all killed. And it seems to imply that Michael, the second daughter, is the one who actually raised these sons of her older sister. So just for a little bit of context, that's going to be history we're going to cover when we get to 2 Samuel. And there's reasons, because these grandsons of Saul are considered sons of or heirs of King Saul. And remember, God prophesied he was going to wipe out the entire dynasty of Saul. So literally all the progeny that come out of Saul, his children and grandchildren, are going to die. That's kind of the story that's told all the way through the two books of Samuel. But here is the man, because David declined to marry the oldest daughter, the one who did. And what is going to happen is, as we'll find out when we get later into the story. Verse 20, here is now the true wife of David coming on the scene. And I say that because we're going to get into all the multiple wives that David ultimately had. And I'll do a thing where I rehearse the history of polygamy in the Old Testament and with the Israelites and blah, blah, blah. But for now, I'm just going to emphasize David as a teenager. He's never been married before. Now comes on the scene his one and only, his true wife now. Verse 20, and Michael, Saul's daughter, loved David, the second daughter. So she loved David, and they told Saul, and the thing pleased him. So members of his entourage, his court, he wasn't successful in getting Saul to marry the oldest daughter, but, he finds out his second daughter's in love with David. He's going to try and use that to his advantage, because his scheme is still to try to get David locked in now with an apparent overture of acceptance with the intent of getting him killed as a result. That's still the scheme, which we find out here. Verse 21. Saul said, I will give him to her. I will let David marry my second daughter, Michal, that she may be a snare to him, not as an honor in his mind, but because he's scheming to undermine David, that she may be a snare to him and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. Wherefore, Saul said to David, thou shalt this day be my son-in-law in the one of the twain, meaning by marrying one of his two daughters. He didn't agree to marry the oldest, but Saul is still offering him a chance to be a son-in-law by marrying one of his two daughters, the youngest. Verse 22, and Saul commanded his servants, saying, commune with David secretly. This time he takes a different tack. Instead of literally offering this marriage directly to David himself, because David turned him down once. So Saul's going to take a different tack. And so instead, he's going to send his representatives secretly to David to propose this marriage covenant. Saul commanded his servants, saying, commune with David secretly and say, behold, the king hath delight in thee. The king's on your side. He thinks you're the greatest thing. He wants to honor you, which of course was a lie. The king hath delight in thee, and all his servants love thee, which was true. Now, therefore, be the king's son-in-law. So since David had rejected Saul's first overture, Saul is now trying a new tactic to convince David by planting seeds through third parties, through these kind of secret contacts behind the scenes. Verse 23, and Saul's servants spake those words in the ears of David. And David said to them, these emissaries, seemeth it to you a light thing to be the king's son-in-law? So he's got the same orientation of mind which caused him to reject marrying Merab. And he's saying, I take this very seriously. And in essence, he's saying he's not worthy. Seemeth it to you a light thing to be the king's son-in-law, seeing that I am a poor man and lightly esteemed? Wait a minute, he was the most celebrated champion. And yet he still is viewing himself, in essence, as a humble shepherd boy, in spite of all the celebrity that he has already been experiencing. So David is showing sincere humility, not pretense. He is honestly reluctant. So now how is Saul going to overcome David's reluctance? Verse 24, the servants basically take what Saul said. The servants of Saul told him, saying, on this manner David spake. He repeated the sentiment of what David said to them. All right, now what's Saul going to do? Verse 25, Saul said, all right, go back to David secretly in another conclave and tell him this. Saul said, thus shall you say to David, the king desires not any dowry, but 100 foreskins of the Philistines to be avenged of the king's enemies. Now, this is actually more clever than you would probably spot on the surface of it. And this makes all the difference in gaining David's agreement to actually enter into this marriage to become Saul's son-in-law. How so? Well, first, what's Saul's intent? But Saul thought to make David fall by the hand of the Philistines. So what's Saul going to do? He's saying, no, you would be doing Israel a service in the service of the king, not to Saul personally as a man to marry his daughter. But what Saul is doing is billing this marriage as an opportunity for David to actually serve God and the nation. Because King Saul was holding the office of the king of Israel under the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So now Saul is pitching this whole thing now in terms of his office and David's opportunity, not just to be the recipient of a great honor personally by becoming the king's son-in-law and marrying a second daughter, but in essence to use this as a tool for David to actually serve. Okay? Obviously, Saul's intent is highly deceptive, but the offer now is pitched in a way which makes it much more agreeable to David. What about this dowry? Well, this, of course, I'm not going to get into a whole thing, and I've actually done Bible studies and all this on the Old Testament dowries. I think I did as a part of marriage sermons that I did many years ago. But in essence, it is a otherwise called a bride price. And it was an amount paid to the father of a young woman in exchange for him giving permission for her to marry a man. All right. And so now you're talking about a princess, the daughter of a king. The normal dowry or bride price would have been very, very high. David's poor. He doesn't have any money. And so this is one of the things that's underlying this whole thing about him saying he's not worthy. So in essence, Saul solves this problem of David being too poor to provide a respectable dowry for the right to marry a princess and says, instead of money, I'm going to let you do it by killing Philistines, the enemies of God's people. And by killing the enemy of God's people, you will earn the right in value, as if you paid the king a great sum of money. So verse 26, and when his servants told David these words, it pleased David well to be the king's son-in-law. So it was a very, very clever change of tactic and how to approach David with an incentive in order to enter into this marriage. And David likes this arrangement. It indicates that Saul must, let me finish this first. His servants told these stories, it pleased David well to be the king's son-in-law, and the days were not expired. Well, what does that mean? What's implied here is that there was a time limit. Saul put a time limit on this. So David's going to have to kill 100 Philistines. This was not an arrangement to say, okay, you have as much time as you want, so over however many months or years, when you finally tally up the deaths of 100 Philistines, come back with me with proof and we'll set up the marriage. No, what's implied in this is there was a time limit. If you kill, and if you prove to me that you have killed 100 Philistines within a certain time limit, the time limit is not described here, but there must have been a limit. If you can do it within the next 4 weeks, 6 weeks, 2 weeks? Who knows? But remember, Saul's intent was to set David up to get slaughtered. So he would have put an incentive on this to say, you're going to have to bring me the foreskins of 100 Philistines within a certain amount of time in order to be able to marry Michal. Okay? His intent was to spur David into rash actions which would get him killed. Okay? Verse 27, how did David respond? Wherefore David arose and went. He didn't let any grass grow under his feet. He and his men, and slew of the Philistines 200 men. So David wasn't even going to cut it close. You know, as if he's going to come back with the foreskins of 100 men, and then Saul's servants are going to say, well, I don't know, this, whatever. No, it's like, Saul says 100, I'll double it. Then there won't be any doubt whatsoever that he's fulfilled the contract. And David brought their foreskins, and they gave them in full tale to the king, meaning counted out precisely and verified, that he might be the king's son-in-law. So not only did David not die, he doubled the value of the dowry in killing God's enemies, which means what could Saul do? He had no choice but to follow through with the commitment that he made to give his daughter Michal as the wife of David. And Saul gave him Michal, his daughter, to wife. So Saul was not going to attempt to renege on his promise. This was all public and out in the open. Here's again where David has distinguished himself on the battlefield with his men in killing 200 Philistines, bringing the evidence of it to King Saul. What else could Saul do? He's going to have to follow through. Recall also that Saul originally had promised, remember, to anyone at the battle with the Philistines and Goliath, anybody who could kill Goliath. What were the three things, remember, the soldiers told David when he showed up, that the champion would get? To get to marry one of the king's daughters. What were the other two things? Wealth, doesn't say how much, but the king promised to give the champion wealth and his family freedom from the king's taxes for life. Now, we never hear about that again. And there's no documentation that Saul ever ponied up to actually give David a reward. But he promised, didn't he? And the army all knew it. So that's a whole storyline that we never see followed up. God didn't choose to record it for us, but I am curious about it. Did David's family receive exemption from the king's taxes for life? Did he receive some big windfall in money? You would have thought if he had received a bunch of money, he had money to pay the dowry, which he didn't have. The implication is at this time, David had not received anything and was still as poor as a church mouse. But this is a partial fulfillment, not only now because David has earned it twice, by bringing proof of killing 200 of the king's enemies and having killed Goliath before. He's twice over earned the right, if you will, to marry the king's daughter. Verse 28, and Saul saw and knew, after all these events, Saul knew that the Eternal was with David. I find this fascinating. I'm going to tell you why. I'll read the rest of it first. Saul saw and knew that the Eternal was with David and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him. Everything was on David's side. David apparently could do no wrong, whether you called it luck. Saul didn't call it luck because he gave credit to God. God was literally opening every opportunity for success for David, as if David could do no wrong. Everything he touched turned to gold. He was successful at every turn, and Saul recognized that. Not his luck, but the intervention of God to bless David. And then Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him. Verse 29, and Saul was yet the more afraid of David. Yeah, fear very often is underlying antagonism, resentment, Rebellion. I'm not saying in every case, but often there is an element of fear. That's exactly how God chose to record it here. This antagonism, which gave an opening for these demon spirits to plague Saul, included an element of fear. That's what it says. And they played upon that fear in order to manipulate and to undo and to undermine. So what was Saul's response? Because you might have think, you know, as a rational human being, it's like, wait a minute. If you come to the realization in your mind that the person you've picked as your enemy is being helped by God, God's helping this guy. Everything he does turns out good, and everything I try to do to undermine him turns out bad. Maybe we would stop and say, hold on. Maybe I need to change my whole approach. Maybe I need to get off of this path of trying to destroy. And maybe I need to reconsider my own relationship with God. Because this apparently is someone that God made him the champion. This young kid, this whippersnapper. Saul saw it. Verse 28 shows he saw it. He recognized it. But what did he do with that realization? He didn't change tack. He doubled down on his intent to destroy David. What gives? How do you figure that? It's not rational, is it? Now, if it was just luck, it didn't say Saul decided, well, David's just the luckiest young man I've ever seen. God's not really on his side, which means I'm still in the right by seeking to destroy him because he's after my throne. It's not what he said. He recognized that God was backing him up, which means by Saul deciding to continue to attempt to destroy David, he was intentionally resisting God. There's no other conclusion. This was intentional on the part of Saul. Saul was yet the more afraid of David, and Saul became David's enemy continually. From here on out, nonstop, in spite of the temporary reprieves, and we're going to read about one of them, this is never ending. So this, and I would also, because I've emphasized to you already, I'll emphasize again, this is not insanity. Saul was not insane. He was not out of his mind so that he was unaccountable for his actions. He was sane. He was just overcome by fear and hatred so that he allowed these demons the influence to manipulate him. But he was absolutely accountable. Don't think, as a number of these scholars want to say, well, he was out of his mind. He was like insane or, you know, had dementia or whatever and wasn't accountable. No, he was accountable for his actions. This is an example of what can happen to any of us if we do not guard the borders, the doors of our mind. And if we allow these same influences like fear as a trap, as a hook, in order for spirit beings to manipulate us, we can have the same thing happen to us. So this animosity in the mind of Saul was going to be continual. He was never going to overcome this, which is proven by the rest of the story of his life. Verse 30, then the princes of the Philistines went forth, meaning there's our continual, perpetual incursions by the Philistine enemies of Israel into Israelite territory. This isn't Israel deciding to try and expand their borders, finally wipe out the Philistines from the river to the sea or whatever. No, this is the Philistines continuing to push, to attack relentlessly. And this happens through the majority of the life of David, by the way. It just so happens that God uses this animosity. And just remember, and I'm not going back to repeat the whole thing, why were the Philistines even there? Because the Israelites, hundreds of years before, did not do what God said under Joshua to expunge them all. That's what God commanded them to do. Don't leave any of them. And because the Israelites failed to follow God's instructions, and these enemies, these Amorites of the different sects, including the Philistines, continued to be in the land, they were a continual thorn in the flesh to the Israelites. Ironically, here we are in a time, though, when these enemies are actually used by God to catapult David to fame. And David becomes the instrument throughout the remainder of his life to show literally the power of God against any of God's enemies. Which is why, in the final analysis, God calls David a bloody man. We'll see that. The reason why God never let David literally build the temple. It was his son Solomon who would end up building the temple. David put together the whole plan, the architectural drawings. He assembled all of the wealth of the materials to build the temple. It was all ready, but he didn't let David do it because God says, you're a bloody man. Well, yeah, but he was a bloody man because of God. God was the one who put him in circumstance. But David fulfilled his godly role, but his role was to prove all of the power of God as a champion on the battlefield. It was his son Solomon's role to act in the capacity that is reflective of Jesus Christ, the Messiah, which is the one who then established the temple. So just to keep all of these storylines in the big picture for what's really going on. But I just find it interesting that here, young David, he didn't create the circumstances. He fell in, he inherited the times in which he was born and in which he lived. And it was a time of perpetual threat by these enemies who kept coming after the Israelites seeking to destroy them. Which means he spent the majority of his life pushing back. And so here we have it. The princes of the Philistines went forth over and over and over and over. And it came to pass after they went forth, here come the Philistines again, that David behaved himself more wisely than all the servants of Saul, bar none. Every general, every experienced man, every courtier, strategist, all the ones in the entire nation under King Saul, not a single one of them distinguished themselves the way David did. Absolutely phenomenal. But it wouldn't have ever come to light if not for these battles, right? This is where courage, this is where wisdom is actually demonstrated in the midst of threat, times of trial. If everything was always good, then there's no way for anybody to distinguish themselves of what their character, what their mettle is, except when they're under pressure and under threat. That's when you find out what a person's character is really about. So God created these circumstances that actually put David in the front lines, and he distinguished himself every single time by God's special help. That's the key. It was by God's special inspiration to give him the wisdom and the circumstances so that David came out always as the champion. David behaved himself more wisely than all the servants of Saul, so that his name was much set by. He established himself, I don't know how many months, years we're talking about now from the time of the battle with Goliath to now. We're not given a timeline, but some amount of time has elapsed over which David now has been catapulted into the mind and the conscience of all of the people of the entire nation. He's met every challenge, and his reputation continues to swell. All right, chapter 19. Here we find out Jonathan attempts to broker peace and reconciliation between his father and David. So 1 Samuel 19, verse 1, we read, Saul spake to Jonathan, his son, and to all his servants. So Saul, basically in a conclave with all his closest advisors, consultants, his entourage, including his oldest son Jonathan, who is the heir apparent to Saul. Saul spake to Jonathan and his son and to all his servants that they should kill David. So unlike what we just covered in chapter 18, where Saul is clandestinely trying to set up a circumstance so that David gets killed and Saul can wash his hands of responsibility, at this point now, all of that's gone. Saul has given up the pretense. And now Saul is committed to doing whatever it takes in order to kill David, which means he's now created this outward plan with his inner circle. So now a whole lot of people know. No secret. No scheming anymore, just outright. David needs to die. And now he's pressing all of his closest confidants into a plan, literally to take him out. An assassination is what we're talking about. Verse 2, but Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted much in David, as we already read. And Jonathan told David, which means technically Jonathan became guilty of a conspiracy against his own father here by running to the king's enemy and basically dishing on the plan to assassinate David. Jonathan now literally has committed treason. From a technical standpoint, the way human governments look at it, Jonathan committed treason right here. And I point that out just to show you the difference in the orientation of mind of Jonathan. This wasn't just some inconsequential thing. Oh, by the way, David, my dad's trying to kill you. No, he had to make a calculated decision to commit treason against his father and literally the court of Saul by going to David with this intelligence. Jonathan told David, saying, Saul, my father, seeks to kill you. Now, therefore, I pray thee, take heed to thyself until the morning, and abide in a secret place and hide thyself. He's seeking for David to be saved from this assassination attempt. So he tells him, you gotta hide, and you gotta hide right now. Verse 3, Jonathan says, and I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where thou art. Now, we don't get any more details about this. They're going to go outside the city, outside his castle, his fortress, out into a field. And Jonathan is setting it up so that David is actually hiding in this same field nearby. It does not tell us whether David overheard the conversation between Jonathan and Saul. It doesn't indicate that one way or the other, but it's possible. Scholars are going to speculate, and they do, that it's very likely that David literally was in earshot to hear this conversation between Saul and Jonathan. He says, I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where thou art, and I will commune with my father of thee about you. And what I see, that I will tell you. So it's not necessary that David overheard it himself, but Jonathan is committed that he's going to report to David the outcome of this special convocation with his father. Another similar situation is going to happen in chapter 20. So it's not going to be too long till we get to that one. The outcome is going to be very different in chapter 20 than the one that was here. Verse 4, Jonathan spake good of David unto Saul his father. Jonathan's trying to remind his father that David hasn't done anything to him. He's no threat. He's only done good to Saul and Israel. Spake good of David unto Saul his father and said unto him, let not the king sin against his servant. Jonathan is parlaying God's commandments into this discussion. This is not just man against man, like playing chess. He's saying, if you do what you've determined to do, you're actually going to be sinning against God. Sin is the transgression of the law. God is the lawgiver. So Jonathan is couching this whole scheme in terms of morality, right and wrong, in the eyes of God. Let not the king sin against his servant, against David, because he hath not sinned against thee. David's never done anything wrong to you. He's never threatened you. And because his works have been to thee were very good. Everything David's ever done has been good for Saul. That is, if you think about it from the terms of Saul in his office as king over Israel under God. Verse 5, for Jonathan says, he, David, did put his life in his hand and slew the Philistine. He's telling his dad, have you forgotten about this young kid who literally killed the Philistine champion that no one else could go against? And the Eternal wrought a great salvation for all Israel. Thou sawest it, Jonathan says to Saul. You saw it. You were there. You were a witness with your own eyes. And you rejoiced. He says, you celebrated when the giant fell. Wherefore then will you sin against innocent blood and slay David without a cause? A pretty cheeky thing to say to your father when you know his frame of mind and his intents in this conspiracy to assassinate an enemy. How courageous do you think Jonathan had to be even to engage in this conversation with his father? We, I think, very often take these things for granted. It took courage for him to have this conversation with his dad. And Saul hearkened unto the voice of Jonathan. Do you think God inspired Jonathan with the words that actually touched the heart of his father for the moment? Yeah. And because everything Jonathan was saying was full of wisdom and truth, and it almost like brought Saul for a moment where the clouds of his tortured mind cleared and he was able to be reminded of the truth of the circumstance and the fact that David was innocent and was a blessing to the nation of Israel. And for a brief moment, Saul with clarity remembered that it was all true. Saul hearkened to the voice of Jonathan, and Saul swear. He made a vow. He made a promise before God, as the Eternal liveth. How significant do you think that was to make this vow before God and use the name of God? As the Lord liveth, he said, he shall not be slain. How long did that last? Not very. But the rational Saul momentarily emerged again through the plea of his eldest son, Jonathan. Verse 7, Jonathan called David, and Jonathan showed him all those things, reported the good news, not only that Saul agreed with him, but vowed before God to protect his life. And Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he, David, was in his presence as in times past, accepted in the royal court as a favored member. Happy ending, right? If you stop right there, yes, but no. So the best word I have, I'm not aware that it's in the Bible, but the word that describes Saul's feeling toward David is the word ambivalence. Do you know what ambivalence is? Ambivalence is love-hate at the same time. The word ambivalence, it's a state of having simultaneous and conflicting feelings, attitudes, or emotions toward a person or an object or something, such as attraction and repulsion, love and hate, desire and aversion, all at the same time. We just say it's a love, ambivalence is a love-hate relationship. Not love followed by hate, it's simultaneously love and hate. Comes from a German word, actually, that literally means strength on both sides. Competing forces that are vying one against the other. I guarantee you that a state of ambivalence creates the opposite of peace. When we are caught in a mindset of ambivalence, I forfeit peace. What Saul is demonstrating here in the story in Saul's life, from the time that he rebelled against God and God pulled away his special favor to guide and to protect Saul, and because of this weakness of mind that was exploited by these demons, now Saul finds himself plunged into this state. The rational Saul still remembers that David is innocent. David's a good guy. David's being inspired and led by God to do great things. He admitted it already. And at the very same time, he hates him through jealousy and envy and through fear of losing his own throne. So both are true at the same time. Ambivalence is the best word for it. Verse 8, and there was war again. Here come the Philistines. Just wait. During this period of time, they were never vanquished. They were always a threat, always coming back, God permitted. There was war again. And David went out and fought with the Philistines and slew them with a great slaughter. No details given. More incredible exploits of David and his mighty men on the battlefield against the enemies of Israel. And they, the Philistines, fled from him. Do you think David made a name among the enemies of Israel as much as of the Israelites? Oh, yeah. And by the way, you're going to see that come in future chapters when David is set on the run outside the bounds of Israel into the territory of his enemies. Everybody knows who David is. Everybody knows the name of David and the exploits of David because of all of these precursor events now which have built this reputation. And they, the Philistines, fled from him, verse 9. And the evil spirit from the Eternal was upon Saul. It didn't say how much time elapsed before this reconciliation, welcoming David back into his court. How long? Long enough in order for David to have to go out and fight the enemies of Israel again to make an even bigger name for himself. Is this weeks? Is it months? We don't know. But the inevitable happens. Saul succumbs again to his feelings of fear and jealousy. The evil spirit from the Eternal was upon Saul, and he sat in his house with his javelin in his hand. Again, a lot of the commentators, I think I made this statement from before, they claim that kings of the day very often used a javelin like a scepter. So it wasn't literally just an implement of war, but the king sitting on his throne, instead of holding an ornate scepter like royal families will today, actually used this short spear, this javelin, as a sign of his authority. And that was kind of, maybe so, maybe not. But here he is, sitting there in his throne room, if you will, with a javelin in his hand. And David played with his hand, because again, that's what happened. David would come with his harp, and his music would soothe now the troubled mind of the king. And so things seemed to be back to normal like they were before, David being a help to the king, not only in helping against the enemies of Israel, but helping him personally, which probably chapped Saul all the more, creating this ambivalence, this love-hate, appreciating having the music played by David's hand actually help soothe your troubled mind, and then simultaneously hating the fact that David is the one who is helping you when you're jealous and you hate him. David played with his hand, verse 10, and Saul sought to smite David even to the wall with the javelin. This is deja vu, isn't it? It's already happened once before. But he, David, slipped away out of Saul's presence. And he, Saul, smote the javelin into the wall. David had to be pretty quick to be able to dodge a master with these implements, which is what he did. Now, this time it says he only had to dodge once. In the first encounter that we read about before, he had to dodge him twice. So maybe things are improving. I guess that's how you look at it. And David fled and escaped that night. David's back on the run again. Wait a minute. Where was this peace? Where was this acceptance? Where was this reconciliation? Where was this vow that Saul made with before God to protect David? It's all out the window in a heartbeat. It's all gone. He's back to trying to kill him. David's on the run again. Saul simply cannot help himself being given over to the whims of his own carnal nature and being manipulated and exploited by these demons. It's a tortured mind. This time, it's not Jonathan who helps save David. It's his wife, Michal. Verse 11, Saul also sent messengers unto David's house. So David slips out, but now Saul's literally going to chase him, try to kill him while he's still in close proximity. Saul sent messengers unto David's house to watch him and to slay him in the morning. So a new scheme, assuming David was going to go home to his wife, and so they were going to use this early morning raid in order to slaughter David, to commit this assassination. And Michal, David's wife, told him, meaning told David, saying, if you save not your life tonight, tomorrow you shall be slain. If you don't run for it tonight, she says to her husband, you're gonna die tomorrow morning. Now, the question is, how did Michal know? It doesn't tell us how she was in on her father's plan. But here is now the second child of Saul who actually aligns to help David, which is also a manifestation of God's special inspiration, that David always has the support that he needs. Otherwise, he absolutely would have been slaughtered. So, however, the intelligence comes to Michal. She's the one that warns her husband, there's a new scheme out. Well, he just dodged a javelin, so I think he already knows. But in case he thought, Saul will cool down, I'm just going to go home, let the fury of the king kind of blow over, and then maybe everything will be good in the morning. No, now is special intelligence coming that he has a new plan, literally to send his troop. It says messengers, but they had to be military men, literally to commit this assassination in the early morning. Michal gets wind of it and says, you better run for it, David, or you're going to be dead in the morning. Verse 12, so Michal let David down through a window, and he went and fled and escaped. Now, these are other things we would like to know, like what was the physical setup of David's house? And all we have to go by are, you know, typical homes of the day, as the scholars attempt to try to tell us, you know, the way these things were set up. But remember, this is a royal household. David is the son-in-law of the king. His wife is the daughter of the king. They wouldn't have even lived in a normal or a typical humble abode. It probably was a significant home to the extent that even the court of Saul was that regal. We don't even know compared to other kings. Doesn't say anything about, you know, his, quote, quarters, his castle or fortress or whatever he had in his hometown here. You know, some speculate, well, if there's a city wall, a lot of the best houses would have been built against the wall. A lot of houses, they say, the scholars, you know, say were constructed in a way so that you had utility, space for animals and things on the first level, and then inside you would go upstairs to the second level, the upper level, which was kind of the living quarter level. So whatever it is, you've got a main door, let's say, that opens into the city. The egress, the place to pass in and out. Maybe they didn't have a fire escape. Probably didn't. But I view this, if you like to fill it out in your mind, a potential scenario that makes the story kind of interesting, I view it with this utilitarian first level, which is a workshop. It's a place for the animals. It's whatever. And then you go through the door into this first level. Then you go upstairs, interior stairs into the top level, which then at some point had a window. Was it a window into the side? Or let's say if this was a house built against the city wall, was this a window through the city wall? Maybe not. But regardless, it was a second level that had access out to escape. There wasn't a door, which is why he had to be let down. in order to get away. He couldn't. There was no door to exit that was not being covered by these guards, these assassins of Saul. So Michal let David down through a window. So they saw him go in the house. He's in the house, as far as they know. And there's no other regular exit, which means they think he's still in the house, but he's escaped out the window. And he went and fled and escaped. Verse 13, and Michal took an image. Oh, we got to talk about this. And laid it in the bed and put a pillow of goat's hair for his bolster and covered it with a cloth. She literally put a dummy in his bed. We would say, have you ever done this like when you were kids? You wanted your mom to think you were in your room asleep and you took some pillows and piled up under the covers and then you were somewhere else? I never did that. This is exactly what Michal did. She literally put, I'm going to call it a straw man. That's a modern term for a dummy. Now, you hear that in political terms, where people who are trying to win an argument and they create a straw man. And then they destroy the straw man as if they've accomplished something or all they did was create a bunch of smoke and mirrors. Different issue. But it comes from the same thing. Now, the problem is with this word in the Hebrew for an image. The scholars will tell you that it applies very specifically to an idol. And my question is, why did David have some kind of a pagan idol in his home, which would have been a direct violation of the Ten Commandments? And there's no answer to it. I just wonder, so some say, well, it was Michael's, it wasn't David's, but he tolerated his wife who had, well, she was Israelite too. Well, the Israelites were pagans. Come on. They were God's people in name, but they were practicing all of this heathenism from their neighbors around. So maybe it was. But a full-size idol, a full-size human size that would have, like, you put it under a cover and it looks like a full-size human being is under the covers? I mean, that's not some little, you know, Buddha statuette. That's got to be something pretty big. So I don't know. It's a conundrum to me. I like the idea instead that this word means broadly more than a pagan idol and could have been used for a straw man or a dummy. But that's just because I like it better. But I'm telling you at least what the scholars say. Laid in the bed, put a pillow of goat's hair for a bolster. And this is talking about almost like a prop at the head of the bed that would lift you up a little bit. And apparently then what she did is use this goat skin on the top to make it look like David's hair. And now you've got the cover over this lump in the bed with apparently David's hair appearing. So that anybody who come in the room would look at it would say, there's somebody in the bed. And when Saul sent messengers to take David in the morning as planned, prearranged, she said, he's sick. David's sick in the bed. He can't come out. Saul sent the messengers again, so they must have gone away. She said, my husband's sick. He can't get out of bed. Maybe they looked in the room, saw what they thought was him laying in the bed, and they went back to Saul and said, what do you want us to do now? Saul sent the messengers again a second time. What was the lapse in time? We don't know. To see David saying, bring him up to me in the bed that I may slay him. I don't care if he's sick or not. Haul the whole bed out, because I'm going to kill him. And when the messengers were come in, they're going to take him, whether he's sick or not. Behold, there was an image in the bed with a pillow of goat's hair for the bolster. Now they figured out they've been duped. And Saul said unto Michal, oh boy, here comes the king's wrath toward his daughter, because she has obviously conspired to get David away from the threat. How long has David been gone? Hours. He left the night before out through the window. All this dilly-dallying now the next morning, she's just buying for time, giving him plenty of time to get away. Saul said to Michal, Why have you deceived me so and sent away mine enemy that he has escaped? How dare you betray your father? And remember, hearken back to what we read at the beginning. Remember when Saul first decided now to, when he found out Michal loved David? Oh, that's his great plan because I'm going to marry my daughter off to him so that she will become a snare to him. But see, love is interesting, isn't it? She chose to save her husband rather than to show honor and respect. So she became just as much a traitor to the king as her older brother Jonathan did. I find that fascinating. They were both guilty of treason. But now what does Michal do? She's the one in the crosshairs of her father now because she's been caught in this treasonous act. Why, Saul said, have you deceived me so and sent away mine enemy that he's escaped? And Michal answered Saul, he said unto me, let me go. Why should I kill thee? Okay, what does that mean? Here's what she's really saying. Michal says, David said to me, help me escape or else I'm going to kill you. In other words, she claims David threatened her life. She only helped David escape because he threatened to kill her if she didn't. So that was Michael's story, obviously, and it was a lie. David didn't threaten his wife. He didn't even know about it. If Michal hadn't told him, there's this plot to kill you and you got to get out now, and she helped him out, David would have been dead. But she lies to her father and said, sorry, Dad, I only did it because he threatened my life if I didn't help him escape. Which apparently then, you know, took away the threat from her father. But it was a lie. So who did Michael's lie help? It didn't help David. David was already gone. She was helping herself. She was helping her. She was trying to save her own skin by lying to her father about why she participated in treason. The lesson you and I can take out of that, if you ever feel like, for the sake of morality and conscience, you need to do something which is against the power that be, and you may run into that, but you need then to be willing to own up to it. Don't lie about it. If you do it, don't follow a courageous act to do what's right in the face of a threat by then lying about it after the fact. Oh, we all have the tendency to do just like Michal did. That would be my knee-jerk reaction. I didn't do it. I was forced. That would come out of my mouth so easy, I wouldn't even have to think about it. I'd lie. But to do the right thing, which is not to lie. Okay? So she helped David escape. Good for her. That was the right thing to do. Literally to put God above her father. But if you're going to do the right thing and step out, then step out all the way. And if you're asked about it, be willing to admit the truth, not to lie. Or just say, no comment. You always have the right to say no comment. But you'll probably get killed. Chapter 19, verse 18. So David fled and escaped. Where did he go? Not too far away, 3 to 5 miles at most. To find Samuel in Ramah, this hometown of Samuel. He escaped and came to Samuel to Ramah and told him all that Saul had done to him, and he and Samuel went and dwelt in Naoth. What's that? Sources suggest this place, Naoth, was not a main residential area of the town of Ramah where Samuel lived, but nearby and possibly a cluster of dwellings where Samuel oversaw a school of the prophets. Okay, a community of prophets who lived and studied together. So it's this conclave of these religious men of the Levites nearby, but not directly where Samuel lived. Verse 19 now we read, and it was told Saul, so Saul had spies everywhere. It was told Saul, saying, behold, David is at Naoth in Ramah. He fled to find Samuel. So what happened? And Saul sent messengers It's basically a troop of soldiers who these messengers are. He sent this entourage in order to take David. And when they saw the company of the prophets prophesying, so here comes this band of soldiers with instructions from the king to find David, take him captive, and haul him back. But when they saw the company of the prophets prophesying and Samuel standing as appointed over them, the Spirit of God was upon the messengers of Saul, and they also prophesied. Okay, what's really going on here? Again, you and I think in the English, the prophesied is like speaking prophecies, revealing secrets about the future. No. It just means, in the Old Testament as well as the New Testament, speaking in an inspired manner. And most of the commentators agree that what the form of prophesying or inspired speaking was literally singing psalms. Literally, probably what they were doing is singing here. And that makes perfect sense to me when you think about this band of soldiers that's intent on fulfilling their mission and they're coming to this little town, but they show up in time to hear the beautiful psalms being sung by this band of Levites being led by none other than Samuel the prophet, who is still this most prestigious historical mentor in the nation. And these Israelite soldiers were overcome with the emotion of what they were hearing. Now, if it wasn't singing, then somebody was doing a good job of giving a good sermon. But I doubt, I just, in my mind, I don't see anybody, you know, orating some thing that gets all these soldiers all weepy and weak in the knees. But music has that power. And so when I see this story in my mind, that's the way I play it, because I can get behind that picture. That they come upon this glorious choir singing this beautiful music inspired by God concerning the God of Abraham. And they were emotionally affected by it and joined in. How do you join into prophesying if you don't have a gift? But you can always join into inspired speaking through singing hymns. So that's the way I see it in my head. Verse 21, okay, well, that group of soldiers, what losers. They were so weak-minded. They gave in. And when it was told to Saul what happened, his chosen men who went to arrest David, and instead they join in with these Levites. When it was told Saul, he sent other messengers. And they prophesied likewise. Same thing happened. Not once, but twice. The new band sent out is affected in the very same way. They join in with the Levites and with Samuel and singing praises to God. And Saul sent messengers again the third time. Third time's a charm, right? And they prophesied also. The exact same thing happens. Every single group of soldiers that Saul sends out is emotionally affected in the very same way. Not once, not twice, but three different bands. If you were Saul, what would you be thinking? I'm surrounded by idiots. What is wrong with these people? So he finally decides, after three failed attempts to arrest David, I guess I'm going to have to do it myself. Then went he, Saul, also to Ramah, and came to a great well that is in Sheshu, and everything I can find on it seems that it was a major landmark on the road, on the passage between Ramah, between Gibeah, where Saul's court was, and Ramah, where Samuel was, about 3 to 5 miles total distance. And this was a famous well of some kind, a water source on the road, a great cistern, some of them call it. So then went he also to Ramah and came to a great well that is in Sheshu. And he asked and said, where are Samuel and David? And one said, behold, they be at Naoth in Ramah, the same place. So they haven't moved. They are aware now that Saul is sending out bands of soldiers. Samuel and David aren't doing anything. They're not fleeing somewhere else to get away. They're staying put, which is also very interesting. So Saul comes and asks for an updated intelligence, assuming they wouldn't be there anymore. Nope, they're in the same place they've been this whole time. Verse 23, and he went thither to Naoth of Ramah, and the Spirit of God was upon him also. And he went on and prophesied. Same thing happened to Saul that happened to these three different bands of his soldiers until he came to Naoth. So this happened to him even before he got there. And he was overwhelmed by this positive feeling. Was it because he was in earshot of the music, if I'm right, about it being psalms being sung? Who knows? But God creates this miracle so that even King Saul, in his terrible frame of mind, is affected positively, and he does exactly what his soldiers do, which confirms the weakness of the mind of Saul. I told you it's ambivalence, it's love-hate. There's still a good element there in Saul that recognizes truth and morality. It's just being overwhelmed by this evil spirit. What did Saul do more? Verse 24, and he stripped off his clothes also and prophesied before Samuel in like manner and lay down naked all that day and all that night. Wherefore, they say, is Saul also among the prophets? And that harkens right back. Do you remember in the early life of Saul when he was first picked as a humble man by God, pointed out by Samuel? That's back in 1 Samuel chapter 10. I'll just read a couple of verses here in closing this afternoon. This was verse 9 of chapter 10 says, and it was so that when he had turned his back to go from Samuel, God gave him another heart. God gave him a special inspiration that stirred up within Saul this positive orientation of mind. And all those signs came to pass that day, verse 10, and they came thither to the hill. Behold, a company of prophets met him, and the Spirit of God came upon him, and he prophesied among them. If you turn back to verse 5 yourself, where it says, because they saw Saul literally, and if it was the same thing, because these same prophets in that day also are said in verse 5 to be carrying musical instruments, which is another part of my reason, I guess, for speculating. It was a musical troop of Levites, very likely. Music was the source or the means of their prophesying, of their speaking in an inspired manner. And Saul joining in, and what did they say? Is Saul among the prophets? So this is the second time in Saul's life when this happened, hearkening right back to when he was a malleable servant in the hands of God before he turned to rebellion. And now this instance is literally reminiscent of those old events early in his life. He's affected again by God's Spirit temporarily and literally joins in with the prophets under Samuel. All right, that brings us to the end of chapter 19. We're on track here. Next time, we're going to continue the story of David in chapter 20.
The Church of God the Eternal has just presented the 19th message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled A Survey of the Books of Samuel, given in Eugene, Oregon, January 3rd, 2026.